Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back. We are diving into the New York ratification debates. But before we do, let me at least say the obligatories. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And as you know, this is the only show that provides you the constitutional evidence that the Constitution was defined not as they're practicing it, but as a compact, as a limited compact. We get into all of this. This is why the ratification debates are so important. If you want to understand exactly what is constitutional, why something isn't constitutional, you've got to read the ratification debates. You do not need to listen to people in dark robes, politicians, and bureaucrats. I am telling you, the framers did all of the work. They did all the heavy lifting for us. So that's why we go through these. So if you start downloading the podcast, the shows from the 29th of March to today and beyond until we're done with the ratification debates, you're basically going to have an audiobook at your disposal going through all of these insightful terms and definitions that the framers provided us. Are you stuck? Are you really stuck in that news cycle that you just, what the heck is going on? Why are they protesting now? What I am telling you, and as a matter of fact, I found it very interesting that David Zinga and the Tactical Civics has a slant on the news cycle and watching the news. And basically, they're calling it a porn. It's just like porn addiction. And I'm here to tell you, that's a very good paradigm. It's a strong likeliness of, you know, these people or anybody that is caught up in this news cycle of, oh, well, what's going on with COVID? What's going on with Kobe's wife? All of these things that are non-consequential. They have nothing to do, and they will not help you and I save our republic. They're distractions, and they're designed to consume our time, just like anything else that's addictive. Whether that be gambling, porn, drinking, drugs, it does not matter. Addictive behavior is destructive, not just for you, but for society. Now, as you know, we just wrapped up Massachusetts. And as I kind of mentioned, I think in the last episode, I'm going to mention this a couple of times. I don't necessarily care to, you know, peddle my wares, my books, or sell anything, but I need to get to Red Pill Expo, and I need to get some financial assistance because the financing or the assistance that we were banking on is just not coming in. And I'll put it to you like this: when the good people that are, you know, wanting to, you know, set aside their get money to you, and the thing that's holding them up is somebody's health, that this loved one of this donor, this benefactor, whose health is so bad that it's just consuming their life. Well, you know, are you the type that is going to just pray for that person to pass so that you can get what you need? No, I believe the good Lord, He will provide. I believe that, you know, we can come up with what we need just to do the few things we need to get done this coming summer. I've got to make a few trips. One of them is to South Dakota. One of them is to Wyoming. And another one, at a minimum, is to Montana. So I got to do these three trips this summer so that we can get face-to-face with state legislators to help educate. Now, I've talked and talked and talked to lots of people. Everybody agrees that we have to get to some semblance of education. One thing that nobody ever thinks about is training the trainer. And who are the trainers? Who are those that need to be educated so that they can start educating the masses? I'm telling you, that's your state legislators. Let them be the ones in leading the education. They shouldn't be the ones, if they're out there telling you, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do this legislation. What they're doing is they're managing an agenda. They're not leading and restoring this republic. And so what we need to do is we need to get face to face with some of these state legislators so that they can have the opportunity to learn and get engaged and get involved. Anyway, if you've got any comments, questions, or what have you, 425-270-5416. And oh, if I'm going to peddle the books, I might as well tell you, if you buy the blue book, the first book, I think it's like $35. If you buy that book, which I will sign, I will also sign the second book and send that along to you as well. That way you can have both books. And what we're looking to do, I don't have them yet, so I can't promise it, but I need to find... And as a matter of fact, if you know where we can get a really good deal on small little CDs, where we can basically throw all of our published stuff, stuff that's still in rough draft and other things, so that you can kind of read some of the empirical data that we've proven, such as the fact that the federal government has set up a godless secular church a long, long time ago and has been working to basically... In creating that church, they have created the Antichrist. And so what we're trying to do is trying to help educate people how all of these things have been done for a reason and how we and what we need to do if we're going to save our Constitution. So with that, we've already closed out Delaware, Georgia, New Hampshire, New Jersey, we even covered Rhode Island, Maryland, and Connecticut. And in most of these, most of those states right there, what they were really that we provided you were the recommendations for amendments, the Bill of Rights, what have you. We've closed out on Pennsylvania, we've closed out on South Carolina, and we've also closed out on Massachusetts. That only leaves three left. Now, Virginia, that's the granddaddy. That's where we had, you know, what out of the first five presidents, four of the presidents came from Virginia. These men debated. They understood the Constitution probably better than anybody else. And that's why the father of the Constitution was James Madison, who was also in these debates. So we're going to get into the New York debates. And what we want to do is help set the stage. Now, as you know, Alexander Hamilton was a big player in the, let's just call them the debates in New York, as well as the Federalist Papers. And as we look at New York, New York basically became a state, or they ratified the Constitution on July 26th, 1 month and a day after Virginia. So it took about 2 weeks, I believe. It was after the 4th of July when New York found out that Virginia had ratified. News traveled slow back then. And the whole point, the whole time that New York was, you know, kind of going through this ratification and explanation, and the reason why you're going to find some really, you know, just marginal justifications and more theoretical stuff is because Alexander Hamilton was stalling. He knew that if Virginia, and he felt strong that Madison was going to win this debate and that the Federalists would prevail in Virginia. And if that was the case, he knew hands down that New York would not be considered outside of the Union, that they would ratify as well. Regardless of what their reservations were, enough would secure the ratification and bring New York into the Union. So he was basically stalling. I mean, you can tell the later it went, the more he got into theoretical stuff and... And there's no doubt, Hamilton was a very smart man. But if you read some of Hamilton's assertions in the Federalist Papers, and you read some of his assertions in the ratification debates, why was it that he was so soft, he was soft-pedaling in the ratification debates versus the Federalist Papers? I mean, he was really staunch, and this is this. Why was that? Well, because the Federalist Papers were not legally binding documents. They were just basically editorializing ideas and concepts of the Constitution in the public forum. Now, in the New York ratification debates, everybody swore they took testimony or they bore testimony, and that testimony was legally bound. So Hamilton knew exactly what he was doing to try to ensure that he would have enough wiggle room if he could get involved in the government. And also, he knew he had a very close, intimate relationship with George Washington. I think he was his adjutant. He worked for him. And as a matter of fact, he kind of insulted Washington during the Revolutionary War, saying, hey, you know, I'm the most capable guy you've got. And he actually kind of called Washington out. And Washington actually goes, okay, you know what, you're right. And promoted him and let him get out away from underneath Washington. But in so doing, Hamilton had developed almost a father-son relationship with Washington. And there was that strong admiration. So he knew, and everybody else knew, that Washington would be the first president. And as a matter of fact, that was even stated in the Virginia ratification debates. If they didn't ratify, Washington and the nation would be denied of his presidency. Anyway, we will be into the New York debates as soon as we come back from these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what we're going to do, like I said, is we're going to do the New York ratification debates, but what we're going to do is we're going to kind of shine a little light on, again, like I've said, Hamilton was lackluster. I believe this was due to the dubious nature of this man. He had his own ideas. He felt he knew better. I mean, he's the epitome of a leftist today. I know better. We're going to do what I believe is better because I know more than you. So anyway, let me see. What day is this? This is Friday, June 20th, 1788. And this is regarding the new system. And as a matter of fact, it was very clear, even in the Virginia ratification debates, because Patrick Henry identified this constitution in creating a whole new government. It wasn't the old government. Most people think that the old government just made, they may just made some changes. No, this was a whole new government, a new system that they instituted. And so this is what Hamilton says. What then shall we do? Shall we take the old confederation as the basis of the new system? Can this be the object of the gentleman? Certainly not. Will any man who entertains a wish for safety of his country trust the sword and the purse with a single assembly organized on principles so defective, so rotten? Though we might give to such a government certain powers with safety, yet to give them the full and unlimited powers of taxation and the national forces would be to establish despotism, the definition of which is a government in which all power is concentrated in a single body. To take the old confederation and fashion it upon principles would be establishing a power which would destroy the liberties of the people. These considerations show clearly that a government totally different must be instituted. They had weight in the convention who formed the new system. It was seen that the necessary powers were too great to be trusted to a single body. They therefore formed two branches and divided the powers that each might be a check on the other. This was the result of the wisdom, and I presume that every reasonable man will agree to it. The more this subject is explained, the more clear and convincing it will appear to every member of this body. The fundamental principle of the old confederation is defective. We must totally eradicate and discard this principle before we can expect an efficient government. The gentlemen who have spoken today have taken up the subject of the ancient confederacies. Hut there, and I actually don't know what hut meant, but hence, their view has been extremely partial and erroneous. The fact is, the same false and impractical principles ran through this ancient government. The first of these governments that we read of is the Amphictyonic Confederacy. I believe that was Greek. The council which managed the affairs of this league possessed powers of similar complexation to those of our present Congress. The same feeble mode of legislation in the head and the same power of resistance in the members prevailed, just like the current confederation, the Articles of Confederation of their current confederation at the time. When a requisition was made, it rarely met a compliance, and a civil war was the consequence. Those that were attacked called in foreign aid to protect them, and the ambitious Philip, under the mask of an ally to one, invaded the liberties of each and finally subverted the whole. Interesting. Later on, in the following day, as a matter of fact, they kind of go back and forth. And this is where Hamilton talks a little bit about some checks and balances. And Hamilton says this: from the competition that ever subsists between the branches of government, the president will be induced to protect their rights whenever they are invaded by either branch. On whatever side we view the subject, we discover various and powerful checks to the encroachments of Congress. The true and permanent interests of the members are opposed to corruption. Their number is vastly too large for easy combination. The rivalship between the houses will forever prove an insuperable obstacle. The people have an obvious and powerful protection in their state governments. Should anything dangerous be attempted, these bodies of perpetual observations will be capable of forming and conducting plans of regular opposition. Can we suppose the people's love of liberty will not, under the incitement of their legislative leaders, be roused into resistance, and the madness of tyranny be extinguished at a blow? Sir, the danger is too distant. It is beyond all rational calculations. Now, I'm just telling you, I read these comments from Hamilton, and I'm going, yeah, really? His Federalist paper comments were much better, and they were equally dubious as well, because in the Federalist Papers, he refers to the word phantom. identifying that it's a phantom that the judiciary would, you know, become corrupt and go, you know, beyond their measure of guarding the Constitution. And I'm going, well, I mean, shoot, look at how the judiciary, shortly after the government with Marshall, they absolutely started aggrandizing their role and sliding the federal government into a more centrist and a never satisfied quench for growing power and centralizing power. Anyway, so this is what Hamilton then says. He says, "This reminds me of a description of the aristocrats I have seen in a late publication styled The Federal Farmer. The author reckons in the aristocracy all governments of states, members of Congress, chief magistrates, and all officers of the militia. This description, I presume to say, is ridiculous. The image is a phantom. Does the new government render a rich man more eligible than a poor, or than a poor one? No, it requires no such qualification. It is bottomed on the broad and equal principle of your state constitution." Now, the fact of the matter is, even back then to today, certain credentials, people seem to be duped into believing that certain credentials mean more than others. And sometimes it's just about whose family it is. I mean, look at the Clintons, look at the Obamas, look at the Kennedys. There are families that if you've got that name, you have that association, you are automatically being given a thumbs up by way too many people. We have way too much nepotism. We have way too much regard for, like, Trump and Trump's family. I do not believe that just because you were raised in that same household, you should have an easier time in obtaining an object of politics, an object of office, than anybody else. And so anyway, the next one is another Hamilton comment, and this is regarding checks and balances as well. And this is what he says. "After all, sir, we must submit to this idea that the true principle of a republic is that the people should choose whom they please to govern them. Representation is imperfect in proportion as the current of popular favored is checked. This great source of free government, popular election, should be perfectly pure and the most unbound liberty allowed. Where this principle is adhered to, where in the organization of government, the legislative, the executive, the judicial branches are rendered distinct, where again the legislature is divided into separate houses, and the operations of each are controlled by various checks and balances, and above all, by the vigilance and weight of the stale governments, to talk of tyranny and the subversion of our liberties is to speak the language of enthusiasm. This balance between the national and state governments ought to be dwelt on with particular attention as it is the utmost importance." Actually, I kind of separated that. "On this particular attention as it is of the utmost importance." That's how it should be gone. "It forms a double security to the people. If one encroaches on their rights, they will find a powerful protection in the other. Indeed, they will both be perverted from overpassing their constitutional limits by a certain rivalship which will ever subsist between them." Well, I'm telling you that he's lying, because he knew that the states would be lulled into these little vestiges of corruption by giving them money from the federal government that the federal government had no authority to do. They can't hand out money to the states. They can't provide welfare to corporations, states, or anything. They have very specific functions and responsibilities, such as defense and those types of things. They can't just throw money out to create an advantage for one state over another. Anyway, moving on, this is what Hamilton says. "I am persuaded that a firm union is as necessary to perpetuate our liberties as it is to make us respectable, and experience will probably prove that the national government, will be as natural a guardian of our freedom as the state legislatures themselves. And I think he was kind of pulling some people's legs, or I should say he was taking a little bit of artistic liberty or license and trying to create this warm, fuzzy, this centralized government. It's going to be a good thing. It's always a good thing. No, it's not. No, it's not. That's why, as Jefferson said, creating a distributive power where more power is closer to the people than away from the people is always less despotism and less tyranny. Anyway, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so moving on, a little bit later the same day, Hamilton then again gets into some checks and balances. And he says, "Sir, the most powerful obstacle to the members of Congress betraying the interest of their constituents is the state legislatures themselves, who will be standing bodies of observation, possessing the confidence of the people, jealousy of federal encroachments, and armed with every power to check the first essays of treachery." Now, I am telling you, he is actually being honest right here. This is the quintessential point of Republic Review, that the state legislatures themselves are those bodies of observation. They have the oversight over this Constitution. It's their Constitution. They are the parties to this. And he says, they will institute regular modes of inquiry. Now, I'm just telling you. So he speaks truth, and then he follows up with this, because he knows that they can be lulled into surrendering and or prostrating themselves to the federal government because of the ability the federal government has in printing money. They will institute regular modes of inquiry, so says Hamilton. The complicated domestic attachments which subsist between the state legislatures and their electors will ever make them vigilant guardians of the people's rights. Well, actually, we have to restore this. We have to initiate Republic Review. We've got to get your state legislatures to recognize, first off, why is it that they don't even know that they possess this power and authority? That's what we have to start doing. And I'm telling you, folks, I can't do this if I don't get you to start doing this and start demanding and articulating in your state and getting others to join you in your state. Well, forgive the French, but we're screwed. Anyway, possessed of the means and the disposition of resistance, the spirit of opposition will be easily communicated to the people, and under the conduct of an organized body of leaders, will act with weight and system. Thus, it appears that the very structure of the Confederacy affords the surest preventives from error and most powerful checks to misconduct. Sir, there is something in an argument that has been urged, which if it proves anything, concludes against all union and all governments. It goes to prove that that no powers should be entrusted to any body of men because they may be abused. This is an argument of possibility and chance, one that would render useless all reasonings upon the probable operation of things and defeat the established principles of natural and moral causes. It is a species of reasoning sometimes used to excite popular jealousies, but it is generally discarded by wise and discerning men. I do not suppose that the honorable member who advanced the idea had any such design. He undoubtedly would not wish to extend his arguments to the destruction of the Union or government, but this, sir, is its real tendency. So he's pointing out again, as was pointed out in Massachusetts, as it was pointed out in Pennsylvania, that there is this possibility of corruption. There's this possibility of abuse of these powers that have been granted. Well, I'm telling you, folks, the only way those powers could be abused is by violating the Constitution. And in so doing, if they violate, then they are susceptible to removal by either disqualification by the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment we have today, or by treason itself, or by impeachment. Anyway, so later on the same day, there gets to be this little banter that I want to share with you between Governor Clinton and Hamilton. And so Governor Clinton did not like Hamilton. A lot of people, like myself, didn't like Hamilton. But Governor Clinton was he was one of those honor among thieves. He believed in trying to maintain the powers of the state and didn't believe in creating truly an effective general government so that the states would then have to actually pay and be, you know, accountable for the services being rendered by that federal government of, you know, the national defense and fighting the wars and maintaining the flow of commerce, the few things that this general government was supposed to do. Anyway, this is what Governor Clinton says. The gentleman, I love the way they don't mention names very often. They just refer to it as the gentleman. The gentleman has attempted to give an unjust and unnatural coloring of my observations. I am really at a loss to determine whence he draws his inference. I declare that the dissolution of the Union is, of all events, the remotest from my wishes. That gentleman may wish for a consolidated, I wish for a federal republic. The object of both of us is a firm, energetic government, and we may both have the good of our country in view. Though we disagree as to the means of procuring it, it is not fair reasoning to infer that a man wants no government at all because he attempts to qualify it as to make it safe and easy. Now, this is Hamilton's retort or response. I only rise to observe that the gentleman has misunderstood me. What I meant to express was this, that if we argued from possibilities only, if we reasoned from chances or on ungovernable propensity to evil, instead of taking into view the control which the nature of things or the form of the Constitution provided, the argument would lead us to withdraw all confidence from our fellow citizens and discard the chimerical idea of government. This is a true deduction from such reasoning. And again, there is Hamilton's, I'll just say, his wit and his literacy, because he was pretty well read and he was respected by quite a few people, or I should say feared by some people. I know that Madison had his hands full every time he engaged in debate, and 9 times out of 10, Madison would win because Madison was more prepared than Hamilton. Hamilton was arrogant, and he just thought that he could just pull things out of his backside in winning an argument. And this basically attests to how well prepared Madison was in those days. When he showed up at these conventions, he would show up each day with a pile of books prepared to go into the academic details necessary, and was known to do so. And so this is one of the reasons why he was so revered. Madison was so revered by people. He was always the most prepared for a debate than any. There was never a point in time when anybody, when they saw Madison coming into debate, there was never a point in time where they thought that whoever he was going to debate was going to get the best of him. They knew otherwise. Madison was, what's a good word for it? Madison possessed the necessary confidence and the necessary knowledge to back up everything he was going to assert every time. I mean, the guy was good. Anyhow, so this is about encroachments, and this again is Mr. Langsing, not Mr. Hamilton. Actually, Mr. Hamilton made a comment, and then Mr. Langsing comes up to make a response to Hamilton, and he says, "The states, having no constitutional control, would soon be found unnecessary and useless." So in other words, he's giving this fear-mongering, you know, basically saying, hey, just like in these other debates, that as an anti-federalist, oh, we're going to lose our state governments. You know, we're just going to become, you know, these a tool. We're going to be used. The federal government is going to dominate every facet of our lives. And so he goes on and says, and would be gradually extinguished as far as the state governments. He says this, when this took place, the people would lose their liberties and be reduced to the condition of citizens to that of subjects. It would have been remarked that there were more than 2,000 state representatives throughout the Union, and that the number of civil and military officers on the state establishments would far exceed those of the United States. In these circumstances, it has been said, would create such an attachment and dependence on the state governments as would give them a superiority over the general, government. Now, let me take a pause real quick. If you get rid of the militia and the militia's role in the Constitution, now remember, they talked about standing armies. They gave us the militia to keep us from having a standing army. That the federal government was to federalize the militia when they needed to create an army. And if they had to create it, they could only create it for 2 years out of these militias. That being said, when they marginalized the militia and they moved into the Civil War, what they did was they basically created a standing army of professionals, not of representations of each of the states. They did this deliberately. So today, when we look at enforcement, the Constitution is clear that enforcement of any federal law is to come from the militia. Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections and repel invasions. Not any other way, not by a standing army or anything. It was all militia. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
To
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I was just talking about standing armies, and we're going to get into the real details when we hit Virginia. But I want to make this very clear that the protection from having any form of a standing army was the militia. This is why only the militia had the authority to be federalized to enforce the laws of the Union. This made it impossible in the Constitution, impossible for the federal government to create an agency for enforcement. Why? Because they knew that the ultimate check and balance against federal tyranny would be the people themselves, thus granting the people the power and authority to enforce laws of the federal government. Therefore, and they even pointed this out, that as soon as the government, the king, and they pointed to Britain, as soon as the king had the ability to start enforcing his own laws, then he captures the forest and basically holds all the resources for himself, and the people starve. This is how they reign tyranny in controlling the people. This is why the federal government was not to be able to do any type of enforcement of their own, that they were dependent on the states and we, the people. So, okay, so we know that they can't have this enforcement. They can't enforce any of their own laws, and they can't have a standing army, that it's to be limited by every 2 years, unless in time of war. And so everything was dependent for the army and enforcement, suppressing insurrections and repelling invasions, on the militia. Okay, now you've got this. Now let's look at what we call the Army. Now, so the Navy is a legitimate force, and the Marine Corps is a legitimate constitutional force, and there are clear powers given to Congress to have a Navy, not an Army. So what they have done is they justified, and they just keep, you know, rubber stamping every 2 years, the budget for the Army to maintain a federal army that has no dependency on the militia. And the reason that this isn't a militia that has been federalized, it's a volunteer force. And if you look at those where those people come from in the Army, that's not representative of the United States. It's representative of very particular states. And as a matter of fact, the whole point of the militia was to ensure that there was equal representation in the Army across the board so that you didn't have, let's just say, biases from New York, California, Texas, and a few of the big states. Bottom line, when we look at the U.S. Army, the U.S. Army has been stood up and has no correlation or link to the militia anymore. And okay, so now we have a legitimately unconstitutional standing army. Well, let's look at the reserves. Well, maybe the reserves are the militia. No, it's not. The reserves are a direct relationship to the Army, and they drill, and they are not based on quotas, nor are they a part of the militia design. A militia design is designed by county in the state that each county has to have requisite representation so that each county can actually have a force enough to be able to suppress their own insurrections or to deal with an invasion or execute the laws of the Union. This way, it was completely distributive. There's that Jefferson word of government, distributive government. And so now we have this thing called the Army and the Army Reserve that is not representative of the states and counties. It's representative of the federal government and only the federal government. Oh, well, hold it. We've got the National Guard. No, the National Guard was another federalized standing army that was supposedly granted to the states, but instead of and by discharging or actually ignoring the militia. The National Guard is another unconstitutional entity that has no role. And I know there's lots of good people that are serving in the military and serving in the National Guard. But when it comes down to the constitutional standing, when the framers made a minute change to the process of choosing the president, they amended the Constitution in creating the 12th Amendment, which basically identified that if the Electoral College can't come up with a president, that Congress shall do it. Now what we have is we have ingrained within the Constitution and the Bill of Rights the militia, that we know that the security of, you know, the sound security of a state is based upon a well-regulated militia. Well, we don't have that anymore. What we have is this institution called the National Guard, which is based on state requirements, not county requirements. They've literally taken away the power and the posse of the sheriffs of every county so that now this distributive government, this distributive representation of enforcement has been now manipulated because, friends, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And if the piper seems to be the state and the federal government, then, hey, you know, that's who's paying us. That's what we got to go do. Well, no, it actually should be coming down. That money should be granted. And basically, what do you want to call that? It should be allocated out to the county so that the counties can have the requisite representation in the state militia, as well as it gets federalized into the federal government. Anyway, so now we have this thing called the Army and its reserves, and now we have this thing called the National Guard, none of which are any semblance or any relationship to the militia. And then we have these other entities that the federal government has created called enforcement agencies, such as the, you know, wildlife reserves, or we've got the BLM, the ATF, the FBI, all of these enforcement agencies that the federal government has been able to assume unconstitutionally. Now, Most of these people that are working in these positions can easily be moved back to the States and be put into militia positions so that they can, you know, continue to do law enforcement and those types of things. You have to understand that we are no longer an agrarian society, that we would probably have to pay these people that would be a part of the militia, the regular militia, not the unorganized, but those who are organized and working on a regular basis as a militia representative and so forth. But anyway, the fact is that the framers warned us and protected us from a standing army. And what we have, we literally have standing armies, a plethora of them. And that was the whole point of going on this aside, so that you understand here they're talking about this superiority that the states would have because they possess these things called the militia that went down to every county. Well, now they're gone. And now we have to reinstitute. We have to start forming constitutional counties. You need to become a part of the unorganized militia as well as the political side. Get involved with the party. There are a lot of things that every patriot needs to start doing. And if you don't start doing it, then, okay, well, I hope you like the new government that's coming around the corner, because you will be the slave to that new government. And some of us will be dead. And that's how it will shake out. Anyway, because I do not see muskets as equal anymore. I'm not a fool to say, oh, yeah, we'll be able to fight our way out of this. No. The technology that they possess and the firepower, all of those types of things, it is just insurmountable. There's just no way we're going to be able to, you know, have any good resistance. I mean, yeah, we'll be able to resist, but it won't last long. And they'll be able to take out all of those who they think will be necessary. Those who know. I mean, look what Pol Pot did. The first people he killed were those who were educated, because he knew that the educated people were his biggest threat, because they knew what would work and what wouldn't work because they were educated on those things. Getting back to what Mr. Lansing had said here. But he said, were the states arrayed in all the powers of sovereignty, could they maintain armies? Had they the unlimited power of taxation? There was no comparison, he said, between the powers of the two governments. The circumstances the gentleman had enumerated, which seemed to be in favor of the states, only proved that the people would be under some advantages to discern the encroachments of Congress and to take the alarm. But what would this signify? The gentleman did not mean that his principles should encourage rebellion. What other resource had they? None. But it would pay, but to wait patiently till the long terms of their senators were expired, and then elect other men. All the boasted advantages enjoyed by the states were finally reduced to this. The gentleman had spoken of an enmity which would subsist between the general and state governments. What then would be the situation of both? He wished, he said, was to prevent any enmity by giving the states a constitutional and peaceable mode of check maladministration by recalling their senators and not driving them into hostiles in order to obtain redress. In other words, being able to go after them, recall them, and get rid of them. Anyway, Mr. Lansing was a delegate at the Philadelphia Convention, by the way, and he was an anti-federalist. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help, and we'll have more of the New York ratification debates in our next episode. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort.
We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.